This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Antibiotics are wonder drugs that have allowed doctors to cure infections that used to kill us. But something disturbing is happening in hospitals around the country. We're witnessing the rise of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. This has been going on for several years, and just this month, the Centers for Disease Control warned about another, CRE. It has been described as a nightmare bacteria, a deadly strain against which even our strongest antibiotics have no power. Hospitals in 42 states have been dealing with CRE. 18 patients at Carolina's Medical Center have been infected since last year. Seven of them died. Here to tell us why this is happening, what's being done to protect patients and staff, and what this may mean for the future of health are three experts. Dr. Todd Steck is a researcher in molecular microbiology who studies bacterial response to antibiotics. Dr. Steck is an associate professor in the Department of Biology at UNC Charlotte and joins us in our studio. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Nice. And you brought me a little gift this morning. He handed me what looks like a petri dish filled with bacteria, and it's actually, I'm told, soap.
Which does not contain triclosan.
You're a very clever man, because I wasn't going to take it from you until you tell me what it was. Also with us from Washington is Dr. Tara Palmore. She is deputy hospital epidemiologist at the National Institutes of Health Clinical Center and director of the Infectious Diseases Training Program at NIH in Bethesda, Maryland. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And for the first part of the program, we're joined by phone by Dr. Katie Pastoretti, an infectious disease specialist and hospital epidemiologist at Carolina's Healthcare Systems Metro Facility. She has to leave at 9:30, so we're going to make a lot of use of you in this first part of the program. Thank you for being with us, Doctor.
Thank you.
Let me begin, however, with Dr. Palmore. I referred to this latest antibiotic-resistant bacteria as a nightmare bacteria. That's a term coined by the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, but I understand that the folks at NIH don't like that term. Why, and what would you prefer us – how would you prefer us to refer to this?
Actually, I don't really take issue with the term. I think I would just point to some of the subtleties about these bacteria. I think in some ways they are – nightmare bacteria, for example, they're almost impossible to treat with antibiotics under many circumstances, and they spread very easily within hospitals. I do think, though, that we have the tools that we need to fight these bacteria, and those are the Centers for Disease Control guidelines for control of the CRE bacteria in healthcare centers. So that, you know, nightmares disappear when you wake up, and I think that that can be true in this case too. If healthcare institutions across the country wake up and recognize this problem and act on it,
and yet we're at a pretty critical stage. From everything I read yesterday about this, that this is the — some people have referred to this as the proverbial superbug that they were warning us about 20 years ago, and that we're like the Titanic, we're not at the stage where the Titanic sighted the iceberg. We're at the stage where the iceberg has already been hit, and we're taking on water.
You know, I think that I have heard that analogy, and I would really look at this differently. I would look at this as an opportunity, now that we recognize the extent and scope of the problem, to begin working together in collaborative fashion to implement the steps that are needed to control these bacteria in hospitals. They are a huge problem. They've caused a huge problem in the NIH Clinical Center, which is the clinical research hospital at the National Institutes of Health. And so we've seen firsthand the type of problem that has you've experienced there in Charlotte. And we also have seen what happens when we meticulously implement the CDC guidelines in an attempt to control spread of the bacteria, and they work. Mm-hmm. It's just difficult to do, but they do work. So I like to think that the ship actually can be stabilized.
We're going to talk about some of these procedures, but Dr. Pastoretti, when did CMC first notice a problem with this?
You know, we've seen an increasing number of cases over the past couple of years. You know, initially it was sporadic, and we've, you know, so far this year we've had 6 people with infections. We had 12 all of last year. So, you know, that's a worrisome trend for me that the numbers are increasing overall. I agree that, you know, we do have measures we can put into place to try to get things under control, but it is very scary on an individual patient basis. About half of the patients that get these infections, they often have multiple other comorbidities, other medical problems going on, but there is high morbidity associated with the infections. And as Dr. Palmore mentioned, you know, we really have very, very minimal drugs to treat this type of infection with.
Hmm. You have said that until the past decade or so, the bacteria haven't been smart enough to outwit all the antibiotics that we throw at it, but now CRE has developed the ability to become resistant to pretty much anything that we can treat it with. How did that happen? These bugs are not smart. I mean, maybe they are, but how did that happen?
Well, you know, I think a big piece of it is that we have been using antibiotics maybe without the best guidelines in place for a very long time. You know, we were under kind of the false sense of security that there would always be an antibiotic to treat whatever infection came up. And now we're running into the wall where those practices have led to the development of these very resistant bacteria. We've, up to this point, been able to have antibiotics developed that have broader spectrum of activity that can treat whatever the next generation of resistant bacteria, whether it's, you know, MRSA or resistant gonorrhea or whatever. But now we're coming up to one where we have developed resistance to all antibiotics because of that kind of abuse in the past.
A doctor at Novant Health told us that we are in the same place with CRE that we were 40 years ago with MRSA. MRSA is a staph infection that started to show resistance to antibiotics and not only has appeared in hospital settings, but now has spread out to high school football locker rooms and locker rooms at gyms and the equipment in gyms. It's now fairly common. Are we going to see more of this? How many of these superbugs, Dr. Steck, are there, these bugs that are becoming resistant to antibiotics?
For MRSA, I can give you some numbers that are kind of striking.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this was a study that was published last year. In 2011, there were about 40 million hospitalizations. And of those—
40 million in this country, in the U.S.?
Yeah. And of those, about 700,000 were staph aureus infections. Of those staph aureus infections, 2/3 were MRSA. So we had over 450,000 MRSA-associated hospitalizations in 2011 in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives you an idea of the potential for how these antibiotic-resistant bugs can expand and grow in percentage of infections. And this is just for CRE. This is the most recent of a continuing growing list of different kinds of bacteria that are becoming resistant to antibiotics.
MRSA is an acronym. So is CRE. So I want you to say what CRE is because I couldn't pronounce it and didn't want to try.
Carbapenem bacteriaceae.
Say that again?
Carbapenem resistant bacteriaceae. So carbapenem is just a class of antibiotics. And the bacteriaceae is just a classification for types of bacteria.
And this bacteria has been with us for a long time, or is it relatively new?
Well, it's actually multiple types of bacteria. So that's just a category. So it's going to be things like Escherichia, E. coli, Shigella, Klebsiella, Salmonella, Enterobacter. These are a number of bacteria that you commonly found, and they also include within them pathogens, things that cause disease.
Mm-hmm. But why is this one? Of all those, because we've all heard of E. coli. We've all heard of a couple of other ones that you mentioned in that same classification. Why is this one, or is it a one, so virulent?
It's more so it's because of what antibiotic it's resistant to, as opposed to the particular genus, species, or type of bacteria, because some of these same bacteria are also resistant to other antibiotics. So these class of antibiotics are those that are some people consider to be the last resort antibiotics that are used to treat infections caused by bacteria that are resistant to these other antibiotics. And so that's why it's been of such concern.
We don't want to scare people needlessly, and all the literature that I've read has, although it's very urgent, it also stresses that there are ways around this and that we shouldn't panic, etc. But CRE has been described as a triple threat because it resists all antibiotics. They can transfer their invincibility to other bacteria, and they're deadly. 50% of the people who get this in their bloodstream die.
Correct. And there's a couple quotes that some people just made this month. Mm-hmm. And one of them is from Tom Frieden, who's the director of CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And a few weeks ago, he said, we have a very serious problem and we need to sound an alarm. And here's what he said about CRE. It's a concern because it poses a triple threat. First, the resistant to all or nearly all antibiotics, even some of our last resort drugs. Second, they have high mortality rates. They kill up to half of people who get serious infections with them. And third, they can spread their resistance to other bacteria. So one form of bacteria, for example, carbapenem-resistant Klebsiella, can spread the genes that destroy our last antibiotics to other bacteria, such as E. coli, and make E. coli resistant to those antibiotics also. And he says, we only have a limited window of opportunity. In the following week, the United Kingdom's chief medical officer called CRE a catastrophic threat. And she equates it, poses it as a national threat, a security risk as serious as terrorism. So for me, you know, you hate to sound the alarm and scare people. Mm-hmm. And because it's easy to be overly afraid of something that isn't yet overly serious, but these people's quotes actually caused me to have some alarm.
So Dr. Palmore, that's how the UK views it, as a national threat. Is that the way the United States or the CDC or the NIH, for whom you work, is that how they view it?
I think we do view it as right now the greatest challenge in infection control and healthcare. Yes. So in a sense, yes, it is a threat to healthcare throughout the nation. And this is actually a worldwide problem, as Dr. Stack mentioned. I think that we do have this window of opportunity to try to control it. But the bacteria have already become widespread, particularly on the East Coast. And I think that, you know, as an infectious disease physician, I agree with what Dr. Passeretti said, which is when you look at an individual patient who has this infection, it is a catastrophe because these infections are very difficult, if not impossible, to treat. Looking at the nation as a whole, I think that we are in a very difficult situation, but with concerted effort, I believe we can handle this threat.
One of your colleagues, Dr. Passeretti at CMC, told us that because you are the region's level one trauma center, you tend to see the sickest of patients and those who are the ones most vulnerable to infections like CRE. So when this first cropped up, did the hospital go on full alert? Did you put some sort of special precautions into place?
It's been a little bit of a stepwise procedure as far as the precautions that have been put into place. We definitely have been tracking it from the very first case. As things have become more worrisome, we've had more cases, we become more and more aggressive with our measures. So, you know, to the point that now on specific high-risk areas, we do surveillance looking for unrecognized people that may not be infected with the bacteria but harbor it and be a source of transmission to other people. We've really ramped up our environmental cleaning in the rooms of patients with CRE to try to minimize any component where contamination of the environment could be a source for transmitting to our patients. We've even gone to using UV light decontamination in rooms after patients with CRE are discharged to reduce that impact. As well as the basics of really emphasizing the importance of hand hygiene. And
Dr. Katie Passeretti is with the CMC. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bonnie Plants, offering gardeners more than 250 varieties of vegetables and herb plants since 1918. More details on gardening tips, planting plans, recipes, and nearby retailers at bonnieplants.com. Our roots run deep. Like so many other things in modern America, domestic violence is coming out of the closet. What used to be seen as a family problem is now being viewed as a crime, but there's still much work to be done. Last year, for instance, CMPD received more than 36,000 calls to respond to domestic violence. That's just last year alone. And we're going to take a closer look at the problem and the issues that victims face Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the Supreme Court concludes arguments on same-sex marriage. North Dakota passes the nation's strictest new abortion laws, and housing prices soar, but consumer confidence drops.
Join us for 2 hours of the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show, this morning from 10 until noon, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about antibiotic-resistant bacteria, specifically CRE, which has made its presence known in Charlotte at the several hospitals in the area and is making its presence known around the country. And it's a very serious thing because this is a bacteria that resists all of our antibiotics. And so 50% of the people who get this in their bloodstream, and we'll talk about how that goes into their bloodstream later on, die because there's no cure. Dr. Todd Steck is with us in our studio. He's a molecular biologist at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Tara Pelmore is a deputy hospital epidemiologist at NIH Clinical Center and the director of infectious disease training at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda. She joins us from their studio there. And Dr. Katie Passeretti is an infectious disease specialist and hospital epidemiologist with Carolina's healthcare system. As I mentioned in the very beginning, Dr. Passeretti, Carolina's Medical Center reported 18 patients. This is at the main hospital here in Charlotte, not any of the other satellites, but at the main hospital. 18 patients contracted it since last year, 11 this year alone, 7 died, 3 this year alone. Put that into perspective with regard to things that people pick up in the hospital that lead to a condition other than what they checked in for.
So it's still luckily a fairly rare infection that we come across, but you know the fact that the rates are increasing is certainly worrisome, and the fact that the mortality is so high with this as compared to some other types of infection is certainly worrisome.
And these numbers, as I said, are just for the main hospital.
Yeah, they are just, we do, you know, we do tend to see more of the issues with antibiotic-resistant bacteria of all types at the main hospital. Patients often have a longer length of stay. There's patients with more comorbid conditions, longer length of stay and whatnot. So they're a little bit at higher risk. We intermittently will see an occasional case at some of the smaller facilities, but they're fewer and far between.
And do you have hard numbers on those? I've forgotten how many hospitals you own or manage, but it's up there. Do you have any hard numbers on the system as a whole?
We don't have hard numbers on the system as a whole. Together, we usually look at on a hospital basis, individual hospital basis, so that we can focus our interventions on where the issues are predominant. So we don't kind of look at things at an aggregate level.
I think that's interesting and maybe surprising to a lot of people, because I understand that the number of cases that we know of around the country, not just in your system, including those at CMC, might be an understatement, because although CMC has disclosed some cases, they are not. Hospitals are not required by the Centers for Disease Control to monitor or report outbreaks. I got to tell you, that sounds relatively insane to me. Why not?
You know, I think it's a little bit of some labs aren't set up to even detect CRE. Sometimes it is a difficult bacteria at times to detect. We don't have a great reporting system in place for a lot of different types of infectious disease, and that hasn't been the priority in the past. I will say that North Carolina is looking into developing a reporting structure for CRE, at least within the state, if not at the CDC-type level.
Dr. Palmore, why wouldn't this be the routine course of action in any hospital for any disease that suddenly becomes prevalent within the walls of the hospital, that they wouldn't know about it, they wouldn't monitor it, they wouldn't report it? Why not?
As Dr. Passeretti mentioned, it is very possible for and a bacteria like this to spread within a hospital and not be detected for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because it can spread silently. And so patients can become carriers without being infected. And when they're carriers, what's happened is the bacteria enter their intestines and live with the other bacteria that normally live in the intestines, and don't necessarily cross into the bloodstream and cause infection. But when they are carriers and the bacteria, the CRE bacteria, are in their intestines, they can transmit the bacteria. So you can have silent transmission in a hospital that isn't detected until patients start coming down with infections. Now, the CDC has issued guidelines for microbiology labs, and labs at tertiary care centers like Carolina's and many other hospitals are following guidelines for detecting these organisms. But we know from surveys that not every hospital in the country is using those guidelines. And the reporting issue, that's a tough question. I think that most states do have state laws that require reporting of outbreaks to state health departments, hospital outbreaks, that is, hospital or community outbreaks. So if there is an outbreak in a hospital, that usually is required to be reported to the health department, whether it's a CRE outbreak or whether it's an outbreak of a foodborne bacteria. The issue of mandatory reporting is a sticky issue, and I'm not sure that mandatory reporting has yet been proven to reduce infections in any state that requires it.
Okay, these bacteria, somebody just pointed out, they can exist. We can be carriers. Sitting in the studio right now, we could both be carrying this in our gut. If we have it, why is it not killing us? Because people who get it in their bloodstream die. 50% of them die. So, Dr. Steck, talk about how these bacteria work and how they live in us with no problems. On the one hand, on the other hand, they can cause death.
Yeah, you'd be surprised to know how many bacteria we actually carry. So
there are more bacteria on our bodies and in our bodies than human cells, aren't there?
About 10 times as many. So you have about 5 to 10 trillion human cells, and you have about 10 times that number of bacteria on and in your body.
Could you back away?
I know. So, and you need bacteria. I mean, we need them to survive. So most of them are doing nothing or beneficial. But some of them are pathogenic. And even though if you have pathogens in your system, doesn't mean they're going to cause disease. So we have a number of defense systems that we have.
Natural antibodies.
Natural antibodies, even our skin, for example, immune system, et cetera. But sometimes you have to have a critical mass of the pathogen. Sometimes they have to have a port of entry, a wound infection, for example. So that they are present isn't necessarily the problem because, again, bacteria are all over.
And Dr. Palmore just mentioned that these people, some people can have these, they can be carriers, they don't know they have it. How would they have gotten it?
The mode of transmission is kind of interesting. Some of it is just the basic hand washing, et cetera, using practices that many of us are familiar with and that we should be doing a better job. But what makes it spread more readily for bacteria is the ability of bacteria to be able to exchange DNA in a way that we can't. So for us, if we want to transfer genes, we can only pass it to our offspring. It's called vertical transmission. And bacteria can do that as well. But bacteria also have the ability to transfer what we call horizontally.
I want to come back to that in just a couple of seconds, but I have to let Dr. Passeretti go with the Carolina's Medical Center and the healthcare system. But before I let you go, Doctor, put this into perspective very quickly for us. Do you feel you have a handle on this? Are there procedures in place to handle it if it gets out of hand? And how optimistic are you that patients coming into your hospital system are going to go out not having contracted this?
So, you know, I'll agree with Dr. Palmore that, you know, luckily people are sounding the warning bell early on so that we can put measures into place to really try to get things under control. I think we're being as aggressive as possible and to make all of our hospitals safe for patients so that they don't have to deal with these resistance issues. So everything from monitoring antibiotics to the measures I mentioned earlier. So I'm hopeful that we can, prevent any worsening of the issue as we move forward.
Thank you for being with us today. Dr. Katie Passeretti, MD, is an infectious disease specialist at Carolina's Healthcare System Metro Facilities. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Let's get back to this bacteria, this CRE bacteria, which is among the bacteria that can not only spread their genes vertically but horizontally. That means if they are drug resistant, they can pass that along to other bacteria that are not drug resistant yet but will be when they pass that gene along?
Yes, exactly. And that's what makes the spread of these resistance be able to occur and spread so quickly. because you can bacteria can transfer genes that are responsible for the resistance to other bacteria like their cousins.
Do they know what they're doing, or is that just something that happens in nature?
It happens. And this is where we get into some hardcore molecular biology, but it's fascinating, at least to some of people. And these pieces of DNA that are responsible for carrying these genes that encode resistance are themselves able to move. It's called mobile elements. They go by different names, transposon, insertion sequences, integrons is a more recently discovered one that's found to be involved in spread of multiple antibiotic resistance. And so these pieces of DNA are propagating themselves, evolution, by transferring them horizontally. So the DNA, what they get out of it is they're propagated in the environment, and what the host gets out of it is resistance to antibiotics. So because there is this natural system by which DNA can spread itself within a population, it leads to these types of great increases in resistance.
Would it be inaccurate to say that this is evolution in operation?
Oh, that's exactly what it is. And that's why it's fascinating. It's natural selection. And so evolution doesn't necessarily have to work at the level of people. It actually works at the level of DNA. So within our chromosomes or bacterial chromosomes, there are parts of the chromosome that connect sort of independent of other parts.
But that's how we evolve.
That is.
Through our DNA.
Exactly.
That's the first stepping stone, the first building block, essentially. How long have we known about this ability on the part of this and other bacteria to do this? How long have we known about that?
We've known about it for a long time. We are continuing to learn more about the means by which these DNAs can be transferred and the vehicles by which they use to transfer these pieces of DNA. But the ability for bacteria to undergo this horizontal gene transfer, it's been known for a while.
Because these mobile particles that you talked about, what did you call them?
Mobile elements.
Okay, I was close. These mobile elements need a host to survive. Does that open the door to treatment so that we can get these little buggers in between while they're transferring, when they're not surviving on a host?
Not really. I mean, there's, you know, the more bacteria there are, the more likely they are to be able to exchange DNA amongst themselves. So it's hard to catch those mobile elements where they're not in a host. Sometimes it's direct transfer. Sometimes viruses transfer them. Sometimes the bacteria contact each other directly and transfer directly. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily that you have to have these pieces of DNA just floating around the environment.
Yeah, hospitals are a place where sick people go. And that's why we've said that these bacteria are particularly they're at an advantage in these settings because people are already ill. But hospitals are also a place, it seems to me, where doctors and nurses and medical professionals are there, and they keep these places, I would hope, as clean as possible. So given that, Dr. Palmore, why do these things sometimes get out of control?
That's a wonderful question, and I think it points to one of the great frustrations of controlling spread of hospital infections, which is that with the measures that we know work to control spread of bacteria, we shouldn't have spread of bacteria, but we do. And I think that there are several reasons. One is certainly imperfect adherence to the infection control measures. So with hand hygiene, you can have 98% compliance with hand washing or use of hand gel. But those 2% that you're missing might be the 2% that give CRE bacteria and other hospital-acquired bacteria the opportunity to spread. So imperfect adherence with hand hygiene is probably a huge part of it. There's also disinfection of equipment and hospital surfaces, so hygiene that can actually be a vulnerability in hospitals and allow bacteria to spread on objects. The presence of silent carriers is another factor that is difficult to control, although with meticulous hand hygiene, healthcare workers shouldn't be spreading bacteria from silent carriers to other patients. And
what would a silent carrier be?
Oh, silent carrier, I'm sorry, meaning patients who are silent carriers, who are carriers of CRE bacteria or MRSA. So silent carrier meaning they have the bacteria in or on them with their other bacterial flora, but with no symptoms. And so silent carriers can be a major source of transmission, and that's what we found in the outbreak of CRE that we had in our hospital.
Let me see if I understand this. In other words, a doctor comes in or a nurse comes in and touches a patient who is a silent carrier. They are not being affected by this bacteria whatsoever. They're in for something else. But the doctor touches that person, then goes on to another patient in another room and perhaps doesn't do a good job of washing his or her hands, touches that patient who becomes susceptible because they're weakened, they have a weakened immune system, or because it gets into a – how does it get into them and affect them, in other words?
Sure. So as you mentioned, a weakened immune system makes people certainly more vulnerable to infection with these bacteria. Being on invasive ventilation, so on a ventilator, or having central venous catheters or other invasive elements of healthcare puts people at risk because all of those are breaching the normal defenses of the body.
If you are a patient who doesn't have this and a doctor does touch you because he's carried it from one patient to you, but you have no You don't have a ventilator. A ventilator. You don't have any tubes running into you. You don't have any needle sticks in you at the moment. You're just there for an examination. What are your chances of getting this?
Well, then you have a very small chance of becoming a silent carrier. But you have if you have a normal white blood cell count and you haven't had chemotherapy and you're not immunocompromised, you actually have very low risk. Extremely low risk of developing an infection. And we have seen in the patients who were silent carriers in our facility, we have followed them over time, and we have found that that many of them have actually sort of decolonized themselves from these bacteria. There's no way to eradicate the carrier state. In other words, there's no way to get rid of them in someone who is a carrier. But we found that with the tincture of time, over a matter of really many months, some of the patients actually, their own bodies, their own normal intestinal flora got rid of these CRE bacteria, and they're no longer carriers. Hmm. So that can happen with fairly healthy people.
We are seeing, I think it's accurate to say, correct me if I'm wrong, we're seeing a rise in these superbugs, these bacteria that are becoming resistant to our antibiotics. Is that true, that we're seeing a rise in these things?
We are seeing a rise certainly in the proportion of healthcare-associated infections associated with resistant bacteria. That most definitely over the last 15 years, starting with MRSA and now with the CRE bacteria. And this is really – this is reflects a worldwide trend. And there are multiple other types of CRE bacteria than the ones that have become most common in the United States. I take great hope in the model of the Nation of Israel, which – following guidelines.
Let me stop you because we're coming to a break, and I'll let you finish on the other side. That's Dr. Tara Palmore with the National Institutes of Health. In our studio, Dr. Todd Steck with UNC Charlotte. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Graduate School at UNC Charlotte and Urban Research University, offering 63 master's, 20 doctoral degrees, and 40 certificate programs. Information at evenhighereducation.uncc.edu. It's Friday. That means the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock. It's the national hour, the Supreme Court concluding arguments on same-sex marriage, North Dakota passing the nation's strictest new abortion laws, and housing prices are soaring, but consumer confidence is dropping. A panel of journalists joins Diane for an analysis of the week's top national stories at 10, the international stories at 11. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
All Things Considered from NPR News is like a high-powered telescope. Every afternoon, we zoom in on what's important around the world. Then, through a clear lens, we apply the correct amount of magnification and focus on the facts to cast the stories of the day in just the proper light. All Things Considered from NPR News. Illuminate your world.
weekday afternoons from 4 till 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHEI. Mike Collins in our studio, Dr. Todd Steck, Associate Professor of Biology at UNC Charlotte, a molecular microbiology researcher who deals a lot with bacteria and antibiotics. Also, Dr. Tara Palmore with us from NIH in Bethesda, where she's a deputy hospital epidemiologist and the director of infectious disease training. We were talking about the rise in these superbugs, particularly CRE and MRSA, and you were in the middle of telling us how Israel has seemed to have gotten a handle on this.
Yes, actually, following guidelines very similar to the CDC guidelines we have here, the nation of Israel, which had a huge outbreak in about 2007, used those guidelines and actually reduced their CRE rates by about 70% to 80%. And I think part of the key was that it's a small country, but they worked together across healthcare facilities and across regions of the country to use uniform guidelines and detect silent carriers, isolate patients who are silent carriers, and prevent that silent transmission that perpetuates an outbreak. So I think that there is a model actually out there for very successful control. It doesn't eradicate the bacteria, but it controls its spread.
If I remember what I read yesterday about Israel, they have about 30 hospitals in their entire country. And that's their hospital system, so to speak. And this is not meant as a criticism of the Carolina's healthcare system, but I think they have 30 hospitals or more in their system alone, and that's just in one small part of the country. And yet there's no communication and no required communication of reporting these outbreaks. Do they report? Do they coordinate in Israel? Is that something that is their plan something we should adopt nationwide?
I think it would be very difficult to replicate the exact model in this country where as you point out, the nation of Israel, you know, could fit inside a, you know, part of North Carolina, figuratively speaking. So, but I think what the CDC recommends is that type of trans-regional and trans-institutional cooperation, working through regional and state health departments. So, I think that it can work. It just requires a very concerted effort across the country.
Let's get to some nuts and bolts, because I'm sure there are people out there who are wondering about this. And Dr. Steck, I just got Dr. Palmore to let us know that these superbugs are, in fact, on the rise. The question is why.
Yeah, and it's actually not surprising that we're going to continue to see examples of bacteria evolve to become resistant to antibiotics. I mean, that's what they do. Antibiotics are to bacteria like any other thing that's harsh environment.
And once they're immune to it, do they ever lose that immunity? In other words, if you lose an antibiotic because it's no longer effective, in 25 years, might it become effective again?
It's possible. If you remove the selective agent, the thing that's allowing those things that in this case are resistant to grow, then there's a chance those bacteria continue to evolve as they adapt to their new environment. Mm-hmm. And so it is possible that things can lose resistance.
MRSA escaped from the hospital setting and into the real world. And that's why we had incidents of it cropping up and still do from time to time in locker rooms and places like that are not hygienically pure. Is the fear that CRE will escape? Has it escaped to the real world?
Well, in the case of MRSA, it turns out that what's called the community-acquired examples seem to now outnumber the hospital-acquired. So there's an example of how it started off being prevalent in hospitals and then has also become more common in the community.
So if you're not using a ventilator, if you don't have a catheter, if you haven't got an intravenous line running into your arm, in the real world, how does it get into your bloodstream?
If you're in the locker room or playing some sport and you scratch yourself, you know, so there are ports of entry, ways bacteria can get into our system. But in general, you know, we're pretty well protected against infection. So it's not something that you should worry about on a daily, but anyone has the ability or potential to carry
the infection.
Have
these bacteria always been present in the hospital setting or in the world at large, or is this something relatively new?
as far as resistance to antibiotics?
Or just the existence of these superbugs that we can't kill with antibiotics?
Well, bacteria have been around longer than we have. Mm-hmm. And there's more of them than there are us.
And we've grown up in a world where we've had antibiotics. Prior to antibiotics, people died all the time from these things, right?
Correct. And in fact, that's one of the interesting things. Another quote from this UK chief medical officer is that, as she says, we will find ourselves in a health system not dissimilar to the early 19th century, pre-antibiotics.
If we let this go on.
Correct. So as antibiotics were used, again, it's to be expected that bacteria, those that can survive, mm-hmm. pick up a mutation that allow them to survive that antibiotic, are going to become more predominant.
Several years ago, we had one of your colleagues on this program several times, the late Dr. Michael Hudson from the biology department at UNC Charlotte, and he advocated, and I want to underline this, embolden it, put it in italics, in 19-point type. He said to throw out all antibacterial hand sanitizers with triclosan and get rid of any antibacterial soaps and cleansers because they, he said, wipe out all the good bacteria on our skin or the weaker bacteria on our skin and let the stronger ones thrive.
He's correct. Again, you're going to kill the ones that are sensitive to the antibiotic. That's why they're used. And if there are any that are resistant, they're going to grow.
How big a contribution is the fact that we are using antibacterial cleansers and soaps in our daily lives playing in the spread or the strengthening of these and the resistance of these superbugs? How big a role is that playing, do you think?
It's hard to know how big of a role. It is playing a role. There are many studies that have looked at the presence of that antibiotic you find. It's not just in soap. You find it in countertops now.
Built into the material that the countertop is made out of, yes.
Antibacterial. There are many studies that have looked at how long does that antibiotic survive in the environment? Is it selecting for resistance, mm-hmm. bacteria that are resistant to it as well as other antibiotics, et cetera? And so that's all happening. And so while it's able to kill most bacteria, it doesn't kill all, especially because we're not always using it as we're supposed to. And so those that are surviving are going to be able to better survive it.
But Dr. Palmore, you said that one of the things that you've encouraged people at the NIH to do, and I don't want to talk about this outbreak that you had of this at the NIH, one of the things you're encouraging your staff to do is wash their hands. So what do they wash their hands with?
With soap and water. And the soap is standard hospital soap, which does not contain triclosan, and or with antimicrobial hand gel, which is alcohol based, and is very effective at killing most bacteria on the hands.
Help me understand this. How does soap, ordinary soap, no antibacterial soap, just ordinary soap, which is what, lard based? I don't know what it's made out of. How does that help? Why does alcohol do it? But how do they work? Yes,
well,
darn.
Is this a question for me or Dr. Stack?
Either one of you, since I can't get it out.
my understanding, and Dr. Stack can correct me if I'm mistaken, is that soap and water, with soap and water, the soap dissolves dirt and grease, and so the mechanical action, actually, of the water flow on the hands and rubbing your hands together, which is a really important part of hand washing, mechanically removes a lot of the bacteria. So even back, so the
so they just slide off. They
them.
Just slide
they
off.
Slide off. They slide off into the drain. Mm-hmm. And with alcohol-based hand gel, the alcohol disrupts the bacterial cell walls and kills the bacteria that way. And so bacteria that have very thick, for example, spores aren't necessarily killed by alcohol, but can be rubbed off the hands by hand washing.
What's the impact, Dr. Steck, of the enormous number of antibiotics that are being fed to farm animals to fatten them up, really? Not to keep them healthy, just to make them healthy long enough for us to slaughter them and eat them.
Yeah, I'll give you some more mind-blowing numbers. So FDA publishes – a lot of federal agencies publish reports. And so the most recent report that came out again this month for 2011 gave some numbers for just how many antibiotics are being used. So in 2011, drug makers sold about 30 million pounds of antibiotics for livestock use. And that's about 80% of all the antibiotics that are manufactured. So the remaining 20%, about 6.5-7 million pounds of antibiotics we take every year. And so with that kind of use, it's not surprising you're going to be selecting for bacteria that are resistant.
These bacteria, I mean these – I'm losing the word. But the antibiotic that they feed these animals, do they remain in the meat that we consume?
A number of studies have looked at the ability for both the presence of the antibiotic and for the presence of bacteria that are resistant to the antibiotic, that they can exist in and be potentially passed on to others. So these antibiotics that are used for livestock, they're used to because they do increase weight as well as marbling, but they also do reduce the incidence of disease
among livestock.
Yes.
But if we are ingesting them, is it changing the flora of our own bodies?
If we're ingesting antibiotics, we're changing our gut flora, yes.
And how many of these leach into the water that we drink? Do we know?
I don't know of any numbers where that has been looked at. And even for these antibiotics that are used for livestock, there is no requirement for the drug manufacturers to tell FDA which specific antibiotics are being used for which particular type of livestock. So that's one of those sources of information that's lacking, makes it hard to get some information.
We have an email from Beth in Charlotte who says, hospital safety is a dire health problem independent of this particular threat. One of your guests today mentioned that even with 98% compliance with hand hygiene, the 2% can be responsible for spreading disease. The fact is that many hospitals don't even achieve much more than 50% compliance with hand hygiene. That's among healthcare workers. Most hospitals are not transparent about patient safety issues, including infection rates as well as fall rates, medication errors, which happen on average once a day to every patient in the hospital. Yet many experts believe that requiring hospitals to publish their rates of errors and infections would drive improvements, since patients or customers could use the power of the pocketbook to reward those with good safety records. Dr. Palmore, you're a hospital epidemiologist. What's your reaction to that?
I think she makes many good points. I think a lot of that is absolutely right on, and I can't disagree with anything that Beth has said.
Also, we had a nurse call who couldn't hold. She said she'd like to know why we don't screen, whether we screen every patient for MRSA, but we don't screen every patient for CRE now.
Well, that's a good question, and MRSA is a lot more common in patients admitted to the hospital than CRE. Now, there are circumstances when it is appropriate to do extensive screening for CRE. I'll use the example of our hospital, which following an outbreak in 2011-12, does extensive screening for CRE. We screen twice a week in our intensive care unit. We screen every patient. We screen twice a week in one other inpatient unit. And we screen every patient that's transferred from another healthcare facility, since we know these bacteria are resident in healthcare facilities. And we once a month we screen every patient in the entire hospital. Now there are different ways to slice surveillance for these bacteria, and every facility does things differently. It sounds like Carolina's is being very aggressive as well with their screening.
Your aggression, as I understand it, came out of a major outbreak at your hospital, at the NIH, did it not? Where you even instituted hall monitors, essentially people standing in the hallway telling doctors and nurses and staff to wash their hands.
That's absolutely true. That actually turned out to be one of the most effective interventions that I think we made. To try to achieve that 100% hand hygiene and compliance with other infection control measures. So essentially what we did was have hall monitors really enforce meticulous adherence with the CDC guidelines, and it seemed to work. So anytime that we have a patient who is colonized with CRE, is a carrier of CRE in our hospital now, we use the hall, we have them in a special area of the hospital, and we use the hall monitors for that purpose.
Jeff in Charlotte couldn't hold, but he wants to know, is there a chance that it's not the bugs getting stronger, but our immune systems getting weaker? Dr. Steck, is that possible?
What I can say is that it is true that the bacteria are getting, in essence, stronger. I mean, they are becoming resistant to these antibiotics, independent of the immune system. And so the immune system is involved in defense. So some bacteria that even are antibiotic resistant, the immune system can take care of. That's an unsuccessful infection.
If you're not a patient and you're not staff at a hospital, but you are a visitor, what are your chances, if this is lurking in the shadows, of you contracting it just visiting a patient? Small?
Yeah, there's actually a very small, minimal chance. And visitors, like all people who go into and out of hospital rooms, are strongly encouraged to use hand hygiene when they go in, hand hygiene when they go out, and follow basic hygiene measures that we all should follow, whether we're healthcare workers or not. You know, visitors are at extremely low risk, I would say, and I wouldn't say it's not a concern, but I don't think there have been any examples of visitors acquiring this from hospital visits.
And in 10 seconds or less, we're running out of antibiotics because there are not a lot of them in the pipeline, because it's not the kind of drug that people want to make, because you only take it for 7 days. How big a problem is that?
It's a big problem. Drug manufacturers or pharmaceutical companies, there's more money to be made making drugs that are used for long-term chronic conditions.
The dollar rules. Dr. Todd Steck from UNC Charlotte, Dr. Tara Palmore from the National Institutes of Health. Thank you both for joining us.